Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Are we or aren't we? Merrill Lynch says we are. Goldman Sachs says almost. The Fed says it doesn't really know yet whether we're in a recession. Whichever way it is, what's the government going to do about it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, January 9th, and it is great to have you here. Don't feel bad if you can't make up your mind about whether or not we're in a recession, because no matter what they say, even the smartest people in the room don't know yet. Recessions are one of those economic phenomena that really only get confirmed when they're long since over and done. Be that as it may, both Congress and the White House are working on economic stimulus plans. Doug Elmendorf is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. We've called him up to find out exactly how one goes about stimulating an economy. Mr. Elmendorf, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
First things first, I suppose, is this stimulus package, when it eventually comes, supposed to prevent us from going into a recession or get us out of one?
Well, maybe some of both. I think that passing a stimulus package would increase confidence of households and businesses, might keep them spending. But of course, when the checks arrive and they spend the money they receive from tax cuts or spending increases, that additional spending at that point could also help to bring the economy back out of a recession or downturn faster.
All right. Tax cuts, we all understand. What spending increases are you referring to? What can the government spend that's going to make us, in theory, spend more money?
Well, there are two kinds of spending increases. The government could extend unemployment insurance benefits. The government could boost food stamps. So there are ways of spending money that puts money directly into people's pockets. The other kind of government spending would be spending on infrastructure. Those kinds of investments may make a lot of sense in the long run, but are difficult to design in a way that makes them effective stimulus in the short run.
I imagine you could break it down in two ways, right? Stimulus and relief that goes to individuals, and then the same thing for corporations.
I think that's right. I think the evidence of the stimulus that we've tried over the last half dozen years is that packages directed at households are more effective than packages directed at businesses. So we saw that the tax rebates that we used earlier in this decade had a substantial effect on boosting household spending. But the investment tax incentives that we used had a much smaller effect on investment and on overall economic activity.
Mm-hmm. That sort of brings up a good point. We've all seen this movie before, back in 2000, 2001. Given that, what do you suppose the president and Congress possibly are likely to do?
Well, I expect stimulus proposals to come forth from Congress before the State of the Union address and from the president, and then for there to be a lot of wrangling. I think it's very important to focus on what sorts of fiscal policies really would stimulate the economy and not just use this as a convenient time to try to get past proposals that people have favored for other reasons.
You know, by the time the president proposes his package and Congress proposes its package and they go back and forth over a couple of months and it's almost summertime by then, isn't it entirely possible the economy will have worked itself out of whatever jam it's in?
I think that's certainly right. My guess is that this will not drag on until the summer, that something will happen this spring.
So give me your best guess. We'll have some kind of tax rebate or tax credit. We'll have some spending programs and then move merrily along and see what happens.
My guess is that we'll have some taxes and spending, as you suggest, but I'm not a political expert.
No, but you are a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Doug Elmendorf is a senior fellow there. Mr. Elmendorf, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you for having me.
One more note on the timing of this whole thing, which could turn out to be important. The president's State of the Union speech is scheduled for the 28th of this month. That's when we're going to get details. The Federal Reserve meets on interest rates. the very next day. You should be getting your W-2 from your employer in the mail soon. Feel free to stick it in that desk drawer until April the 13th or so. But just know that the Internal Revenue Service is on your side to a certain degree. The National Taxpayer Advocate issued her annual report to Congress today. She's the taxpayer's representative within the IRS. And she wants the bureaucracy to change its ways, for instance, to apologize when it's wrong and maybe offer a little something to compensate you for your troubles. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has more.
On a tour of foreign tax agencies, Nina Olson, the National Taxpayer Advocate, discovered the British Tax Office is willing to pay for its mistakes.
When they essentially screwed things up for taxpayers to the point that they were causing taxpayers hardship, the agency would admit that they had done something wrong and make a symbolic payment. It wasn't meant to compensate the taxpayer for all their time and anguish, but it was a symbolic payment saying, "We're sorry."
Olson recommends the IRS adopt similar apology payments ranging from $100 to $1,000, tax-free, of course. Olson also thinks it's time for the IRS to require better disclosure of the growing cash economy, transactions like buying and selling over the Internet, and paying for cleaning and other household services. She says that could net the government an extra $100 billion every year. Kevin McCormerly of Kiplinger's Personal Finance magazine says that revenue could reduce the hit on honest taxpayers.
If eBay was required by law to report to the IRS each year the total proceeds that you sold on eBay, suddenly you might be more likely to report all of your sales on eBay. And as soon as the IRS has information, two things happen. One, taxpayers suddenly become much more honest. And two, if they don't, the IRS has got something to ask them about.
The IRS had no immediate reaction to the Taxpayer Advocate's report. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If you just can't get enough of tax policy, you can go to our website, marketplace.org, to read that whole report. President Bush started his 9-day trip to the Middle East today. He landed in Israel this morning. He'll be going to the West Bank tomorrow. Daniel Estrin reports now from Jerusalem that the stage has been dramatically set for the president's visit, and at no small cost.
Police have shut down major thoroughfares to ensure that Bush can zip through the city as safely as possible. American flags line the streets. At times, no cars or buses are allowed through, and all parked cars have been towed. Moshe Ben-Sioni, an advisor to the mayor of Jerusalem, says just the cost for decorations and street cleanings alone runs $400,000.
I imagine that the people who are going to be stuck in traffic jams are going to be very unhappy. I think in general, the Israeli public is very happy that the president is coming.
Nearly 10,500 law enforcement agents stand guard. That's about a third of the entire Israeli police force. City officials will shut off the lights in Old Jerusalem so Bush can enjoy a more dramatic sunrise over the city's ancient stone walls. It's creating a surreal feel here. One shop owner described it this way.
We feel here like in an American movie. See helicopters and CIA people and a lot of strange vehicles that you can't see in Israel. It's kind of nice.
Securing a political peace here in the twilight of Bush's administration is considered a long shot. He's expected to get into meatier economic issues on his next few stops. He heads to Kuwait, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia, home to some of the world's largest oil reserves and investment funds. From Jerusalem, I'm Daniel Estrin for Marketplace.
Wall Street had no idea what it was doing today. The major indices were up and down and all the way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Philippe de Montebello announced last night he's going to retire at the end of this year. If maybe you haven't heard the name, you might have heard his voice. De Montebello has been the director of New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art for 30 years. He has also narrated most of the museum's audio guides. His decision to do that prompted other museum directors to do the same thing. That helped those guides become enormously popular and profitable for the companies that produce them. But Ashley Milne-Tight reports from New York, some museums have begun taking their tours back into their own hands.
Essentially, a museum within the museum for the Metropolitan's world-renowned collection of Hellenistic...
The voice that launched 1,000 audio tours. At some considerable expense, Jason Kaufman of the Art newspaper says putting together a museum audio tour is a pricey proposition.
Not just the rental of equipment, but the help in writing the texts and then the cost of producing them.
He says with advances in audio technology like podcasting, some museums are opting to design and produce their own tours. Robin Dowden directs new media at the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. It has a program where visitors can dial up an audio tour on their cell phones. Dowden says that's cheaper than a full audio guide tour.
You know, again, we wanted to make it available for free, and of course, they're using their own minutes on their phone, so there's some cost to them, but not much.
Dowden's Art Museum pays $25,000 a year for its program, but museums pay much more for a full audio tour of a single exhibition. Sarah Dines is a managing director of Antenna Audio, which produces audio tours. She says some museums may produce their own, but most recognize they're not the expert storytellers.
It's really about the research, collaboration between educators and curators and our writers, then that's a very kind of niche skill that, you know, would be very expensive and difficult for museums to bring in-house.
A curator at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art confirmed that view. He says a fully produced audio tour is worth the money. The museum can charge visitors to use it, and it lets museum staff get on with their jobs. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Whatever an economic stimulus package does finally wind up looking like, it's going to have to do something for small businesses and entrepreneurs, because they drive a big part of the U.S. economy and economies all over the world. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli covers entrepreneurship for us. He's been hearing some talk lately about a key issue facing those small businesses and developing economies as well. We've got him on the line now from the Entrepreneurship Desk. Hi, Steve. How are you?
Hi, Kai. I'm good.
Connect the dots for us, would you? What is it that has these small business people talking?
Well, Kai, the worldwide theme that's striking to me is that entrepreneurs, especially in developing economies, seem to be raising their voices more and more for a secure rule of law in their countries. They're telling their governments that they need both a good set of rules and an enforceable one if they and their countries are going to prosper.
Make the economic case for me. What's the connection between rule of law and small businesses being able to prosper and why they're important in a country's economic development?
Well, small business people can't feel secure enough to take risks if they don't have both legal protections and secure property rights. And a growing body of study is demonstrating that entrepreneurs are a key driver of economic growth, again, especially in developing countries, but in all countries, including ours.
You know, I was checking the wires not too long before I came in here, and there is actually a story out of Belarus about a small businessman, head of a trade group. He's been arrested, actually, for protesting the rule of law in Belarus. Isn't that right?
Right. This is actually tied to a strike by entrepreneurs in Belarus. They are saying that an edict by their autocratic president is strangling their growth, and the president has decreed, and in places where anyone decrees anything, entrepreneurs tend to get nervous, he's decreed that small businesses getting certain tax breaks can have, at most, just three employees, and they all have to be the owner's family members. And the entrepreneurs say that's a threat to their very existence and leaves them with no way to grow and compete, especially with companies that happen to have ties to the state.
All right, but step back for a minute here, because isn't when people call for rule of law, right, aren't they usually asking for more of it?
They really are, Kai. And the first example shows that you have to get the laws right and make them fair if you're going to help the people who build an economy. But that larger point is right. Most of what I notice small business people speaking up about, especially in those emerging economies, is a push to establish stronger laws. For instance, a couple of weeks back in Bangladesh, there was a conference for native-born business people who work overseas. They were strongly pressing the government there for better and more enforceable laws. Over in Nigeria, a small business roundtable went even further. They identified not only the absence of strong laws, but the presence of their opposite, which is corruption, as major obstacles to growth.
Steve, is there something you can point to as to why this is happening now?
I think there are two reasons, Kai. The first is that in most every corner of the world, the starting gun's been fired on a new economy. People know it, and they're scrambling for a place at the table. And the second reason is that in many ways, the jury is no longer out on the importance of the rule of law. And one person who's been measuring the rule of law around the world is economist Robert Lawson at Capital University in Ohio. He tells me that the findings of his studies contain striking examples among neighbors.
You look at countries right next to each other, like Zimbabwe and Botswana, Chile and Argentina. You don't have to go to North and South Korea even, but countries that are right next to each other that share heritages, share climates, they share religions and ethnicities, and one has got a more stable property rights regime and a better rule of law, and they're doing better, without exception.
What about small businesses and entrepreneurs here in the United States? I mean, generally speaking, we are a nation of laws, but how do they feel about regulation and all those other kinds of things?
Well, you know, the United States is considered to be one of the strongest countries for the fundamentals of rule of law, which is secure property rights and enforceable rights and an ability to pursue grievances. But small business people for quite some time now have been looking to government for help in other areas. The one that sticks out the most, of course, and the one that has been shown to be number one on small business people's minds is whether small business people can provide health care or find some way to afford it and still be competitive.
Steve Tripoli at the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome, Kai.
Coming up, high-tech medicine or cash cow?
It has to do with their profits and how can they best make more money.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks did end higher today after a volatile trading day. Investors sent money into recession-resistant companies. The Dow Industrials clawed ahead 146 points, 1.1% to close at 12,735. The Nasdaq picked up 1.3%, 34 points, 2474 at the bell. The S&P 500 also rose 1.3%, 18 points, finished the day at 1409. Drug maker Merck popped up 1.4%, and Coca-Cola bubbled up 2.3% after Goldman Sachs warned a recession is in the offing. I guess we all need a soda if there's going to be a recession. Alcoa climbed 0.8%, that in anticipation of some good earnings news that did in fact come out after the bell. DuPont racked up a 4.75% gain after it raised its earnings forecast for the year. London's FTSE lost 1.3% overnight. Back home, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.82%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. The National Economists Club hosts a discussion about labor unions and changes in the auto industry. The world's cheapest automobile is due to debut. In India, Tata Motors unveils its people's car, going for a thrifty $2,500. And the man who gave his name to all five of his sons celebrates his birthday. Boxer George Foreman turns 59. Oh, and don't forget about the George Foreman grill. That's named after him, too. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Well, we tried, but there was really no way to avoid talking about last night's New Hampshire primary. We did get it down in the second half of the show, though. As the world now knows, Hillary Clinton got the big win on the Democratic side. Today, the candidate she defeated got a pretty good consolation prize. Unite Here, that's a labor union that represents nearly 500,000 service workers, endorsed Barack Obama today. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gratch reports.
In addition to Unite Here, Obama won an endorsement late yesterday from the Nevada chapter of the Service Employees International Union. Both locals have many Hispanic members.
This is very exciting news for us.
Federico Pena is national co-chair of the Obama campaign.
The endorsement of these unions is key in terms of adding more energy and excitement and impetus to our campaign.
The January 19th Nevada caucuses will be the first real test of the Hispanic swing vote. And for now, Latino voters are siding heavily with Senator Hillary Clinton. Luis Clemens edits Candidato USA, an online Latino political newsletter.
The bottom line, I think, is name recognition. Latinos in the U.S. associate the Clinton administration with the time of economic prosperity and pro-Latino policies.
Unite Here said in a statement that it endorsed Obama because the former community organizer is, quote, a champion of working Americans. Observers say these union endorsements put the Hispanic vote into play. The Nevada caucuses are on a Saturday of a holiday weekend. Unions are very effective at bringing out the vote.
I'm Al Marquez, 50 years of age, and I work in the gaming industry.
Marquez lives in Las Vegas and is of Mexican descent. He says he's looking for a candidate that will protect Hispanics against discrimination, and that's led him to Obama.
Obama understands segregation from a personal standpoint. He also understands inclusion from a personal standpoint. I don't think Hillary Clinton does. I just don't feel that.
The Clinton camp has 10 days to make him feel differently. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Union endorsements are one way some people choose their candidates. Others go for personal charisma or that ever-elusive electability. Some just line up all the various policy proposals and tick them off in a list of pros and cons. Commentator Robert Reich says that is a dangerous oversimplification.
Comparing candidates issue by issue or policy by policy is seriously misleading. It suggests every major problem we face is neatly separable, calling for a distinct solution. But in reality, almost every big issue facing the nation is tightly linked to almost every other one. The first step to finding real solutions is to understand these linkages. Start with foreign policy. The major challenges today are centered in the Middle East, Russia, and China. They're linked together, and that linkage is oil. Even absent Islamic extremism and Russia's remaining nuclear warheads, we'd still focus on these places because more than two-thirds of the world's oil supply comes from the Middle East and Russia, and our economy still critically depends on oil. And why is China building up its military? Most likely to protect its own global lifelines to oil. Global oil consumption, in turn, is the leading cause of global warming. And reducing global warming depends on alternative sources of energy. Nuclear energy is a top candidate, but how can it be generated safely and kept out of the hands of terrorists? Meanwhile, agricultural-based energy sources like ethanol are expensive, and agricultural subsidies inevitably distort world commodity markets. Which brings us to global poverty. It's worsened by crop subsidies in rich nations and also by climate change. Global warming is bad for everybody, but especially if you're poor, living in a low-lying part of a city increasingly subject to flooding, or an area of the world turning to desert and losing its capacity to grow food. Global poverty, in turn, is a leading cause of the increasing flow of immigrants around the globe. So you see, candidates can't really talk intelligently about one issue without talking about the others. Rather than give us 50 words or 30 seconds on each, we need people who can explain the connections and tell us how their response to one would help us deal with the others, or at least not make the others worse.
15 years ago, Robert Reich was the Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. He is now a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. So, are the presidential candidates addressing your concerns? Let us know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on Election 2008. Here's an equation hospital bookkeepers are becoming increasingly familiar with. More patients plus fewer doctors adds up to a need for creative solutions. Often, that means more technology. And it's becoming especially true for the biggest money pits in most hospitals, intensive care units. Electronic ICUs allow for big economies of scale, but they don't come cheap. From KXJZ in Sacramento, Marianne Russ reports.
Sylvius Warner's dad got cancer a few years back. He was treated in a Sacramento-area intensive care unit affiliated with Sutter Health. Swarner is a registered nurse. She works for Sutter. She says her father received a doctor's attention at the first sign of trouble.
His blood pressure went bananas. All of a sudden, the doctor was in the room going, "What is going on in there? What can I do for you?" And totally sold on the process as far as that's how quick a doctor can get in.
Thing is, the doctor wasn't actually in the room. He was in an office miles away. He communicated with Swarner and the ICU staff using a camera and microphone. Swarner was so impressed with the care, she decided to work behind the camera. Now she's the one doing the monitoring at Sutter Health's electronic ICU command center in Sacramento.
This one is 240. Mm-hmm.
It's 7 p.m. Swarner is just about to finish her shift. She's one of a team of five or six nurses and a couple of doctors. They're keeping track of 130 patients in 17 different ICUs around the state.
I'll take you into my spaceship.
Dr. Adrian Lawrence is one of those two doctors. He's an intensive care specialist. He says he and the team at the center are an extra pair of eyes, a backup for the bedside staff.
I have a lot of monitors here. There's one monitor here that has a lot of vital signs.
Talk about multitasking. Lawrence has five flat screens stacked in a rough pyramid on his desk. He can check one patient's medical history and watch for changes in heart rate in another. He can check in on a third with a webcam. He says the system compensates for a shortage of specialists, particularly in rural areas.
We're sitting here in Sacramento, California, and we're monitoring a hospital that's 425 miles away. There is nothing but cows and one stoplight. And we're helping these people.
More like helping the company, says Catherine Donahue. She's a registered nurse in Eureka, California. She's also on the board of directors for the state's nurses union. She says electronic ICUs aren't about improving patient care at all.
It has to do with their profits and how can they best make more money.
Sutter Health says it paid roughly $25 million for the system. Donahue says the money could be better spent.
Instead of putting all this money into equipment and technology, if corporations would hire more competent nurses, they would have better outcomes, and actually the cost would be less.
But Sutter says outcomes are getting better. It says early screening in the electronic ICU has helped reduce deaths from sepsis. And VisiQ, the company that developed the system, claims patients spend 15% to 20% less time in EICUs than in traditional units. That saves money for the patient and the hospital. A VisiQ spokeswoman says 250,000 people in 30 states now receive care in electronic ICUs each year. The concept is getting attention overseas as well. The Dutch electronics company Philips said last month it will acquire VisiQ for $430 million. In Sacramento, I'm Marianne Russ for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, scientists, we all know, are looking everywhere for that next innovation in alternative energy. So how about the body heat of 250,000 Swedish commuters? The Swedish company Jernhusen AB is trying to do just that. The company says all those people could provide 15% of the energy needed to power a 13-story office building. As it happens, there's one right next to Stockholm Central train station. Ventilators will basically suck up all the warm air from the station, blow it over heat exchangers to heat the water that will be piped throughout the building. Price tag, $47,000 American. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow put on 146 points, 1.1% after a very topsy-turvy day. The NASDAQ gained 34 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 rose 18 points, 1.3% there as well. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornoni, Eric Johnson, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, Iraqis caught in the crossfire. Look for compensation.
The maximum paid is $2,500. So that's what it'll be for a death. It'll be the maximum is $2,500.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.